Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Here across the dateline in Japan, it is the 7th of October, 2015. But as we record this, it's still the 6th of October in the United States, where I am joined on the line by Dr. Jonathan Latham. And Dr. Latham, for those who do not know, is a co-founder and executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project, which is the publisher of Independent Science News at independentsciencenews.org. He has published scientific papers in a range of disciplines, including plant ecology, virology, and genetics, and he's the author of a recently published article, Growing Doubt, A Scientist's Experience of GMOs, which I will link up in the show notes for today's interview. Dr. Latham, thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Hi there, James.
All right, let's start with the sort of background to this article. As you say, Growing Doubt, A Scientist's Experience of GMOs, this is your own kind of personal experience, as well as some of your professional expertise bringing to bear on the GMO subject, which we are constantly told in a lot of the science media is beyond a doubt completely 100% safe by now, and there's only strange anti-science people could possibly have any doubt about it. Obviously, you beg to differ on that point, but why don't we go a little bit into your own personal background with this issue and talk about the work that you were doing towards your PhD in the early 1990s?
Yeah, we can do that. So I used to make GMOs for research use. So we used to make genetically engineered plants that basically had viral genes in them. And so we were messing around with testing hypotheses and trying to make plants that were resistant to virus infection. And I did other things in my PhD, but that was quite a large part of it.
And as you write in this article, at the beginning of your research, it didn't really occur to you that this was going to be entering into the mainstream use or into the food supply itself at the time. When did that transition start to take place?
Well, you know, there was already, before I started my PhD, there already was the Flavor Saver tomato on the market. So my PhD started in 1991 and it finished in 1996. And so there already was the Flavor Saver tomato. So, you know, probably we were naive in that sense. But we, you know, we could see, we had discussions around the risk issues of GMOs and how certain people were putting genes into plants that we were unhappy with. And, but, you know, it wasn't until later, and I put two and two together and realized the risk assessment that was not being done to my or I would think any scientist's satisfaction, that you put together the idea that people are making risky things and the risk assessment is not being done well, then, you know, you have the situation for a perfect storm.
Unfortunately so. Well, let's talk about that risk assessment. So what is required in the United States by, I assume, the FDA for a genetically modified organism to come to market?
That's a very good question. There's a lot of misinformation about this. So basically, the FDA requires nothing. Okay, that may surprise you, but it's true. A manufacturer doesn't even need to notify the FDA that they're putting a GMO onto the market. They do, who they do need to notify is the USDA, and the USDA does assessment for whether something is a plant pest risk, like whether it will be a new weed in the environment or something. And EPA has a role if the gene that's being put in is a pesticide. So, for example, there's a BT. BT transgenics are insect-resistant transgenic plants that have a protein that kills insects. It makes small holes in their guts. And so that was approved by the EPA. The USDA has to go through a regulatory process as well. But the FDA does nothing whatsoever, excepting that companies often choose to notify the FDA, and then they get in return a letter saying, we have looked at the details of what you sent us, and as far as we're concerned, it's up to you to determine whether this GMO is safe or not. And it's basically a bureaucratic process.
That is absolutely shocking, I'm sure, to a lot of people who don't know anything about this, although perhaps it shouldn't be, given the substantial monetary concerns that are behind the lobby for these types of plants. But let's talk about the concept of substantial equivalence. I understand that this is used by a lot of regulatory agencies, not just in the United States, but around the world, to try to put forward the idea that GMOs are not substantially different from regular plants and crops. Can you tell us about this concept and where it came from?
Well, there's a lot of different perspectives from which you can describe substantial equivalence. So it's the concept itself is the idea that if you've made a genetically engineered crop, you say you put in a transgene, the idea is that you can regulate that organism from the point of view of it still being the species that you put the transgene into. So if you make a GMO corn, then it's still a corn. And so this is a concept that was mooted, and it actually came out of the OECD, which is a very interesting thing, because the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, is not a UN organization, I don't think, but it is a non-scientific organization. And the fundamental criticism about substantial equivalence from the beginning has been that it's not really a scientific concept. You can't, it's never been tested. And so essentially it exists outside of any scientific discussion, if you like, but it's kind of like a magic, you know, what they imagined it would be is a kind of magic system by which you've got something you don't understand. By calling it substantially equivalent, you pretend that you do understand it and therefore that you can do a regulatory kind of job on it that doesn't involve too much experimentation, too much work, and from the point of view of the companies especially, too much risk that something bad may be found. But it doesn't, substantial equivalence doesn't have a U.S. regulatory, it doesn't have any legal status in the U.S. So different jurisdictions like the EU and the U.S. treat substantial equivalence differently. And in the U.S., actually, they don't treat it at all. It's not part of the regulatory concept.
Very interesting. But this seems, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but this seems to go back to one of the concerns that you raise in this article about BT proteins, basically BT Bacillus thuringiensis, which I'm probably mispronouncing, is a bacterium that has been genetically modified into a number of different crops, maize, cotton, soybeans, etc. And one of the concerns that you raise about this is that the mode of action of BT proteins is not understood, yet it is axiomatic in science that effective risk assessment requires a clear understanding of the mechanism of action of any GMO transgene. Can you break that down for us? What does that mean, the mechanism of action of any GMO transgene?
Well, if you want to do a meaningful risk assessment, say you put in a gene, say you already know that your gene is a toxin against insects, for example, which in the case of BT it is, you might consider the possibility that it also might be toxic to a wider range of organisms. So you might take a special interest in the food safety aspects of that GMO, for example. So you might do experiments on the BT protein to see whether it's safe eaten by itself. You might feed that crop to animals to find out in detail whether it is whether it has toxicological properties that the plant didn't have before. So what we're saying here is that if you understand what the protein inside the plant is supposed to be doing, then you can use that to direct your attention to potential risks. But if you don't know what the protein inside the plant really does, or if it has other properties that you have never discovered because you didn't do enough research, then you can't ask those questions. You have no place to focus your attention.
This is so disturbing on so many different levels. And again, I don't have the scientific experience to be able to talk about this, but it's disturbing to hear someone with that scientific experience raising these concerns, because as I say, the mainstream science media generally tends to portray these concerns as just a silly conspiracy theory or something along those lines. It's not just the direct effects even of these GMOs, but also their ancillary effects. For example, you talk about the agricultural herbicide aspect of this, and I think glyphosate is one that my listeners will probably already be familiar with. The World Health Organization even just recently determined it, or said that it is not harmless, as has been said before by Monsanto. But there's also another herbicide that you point out in this article, glufosinate, which I've never even heard of before. Can you tell us about this herbicide and what it does?
Yeah, it's pretty well established in the scientific literature to be a neurotoxin. And in back in Britain, for example, it was restricted in its the time of year that you could use it. So farmers were only allowed to use it in the summertime when it was thought that the herbicide would break down in the soil. Because in winter, what happens in the winter is that a lot more water gets on the fields. They often are waterlogged. And herbicides and chemicals that are applied just wash straight into the rivers directly. You know, within they can be in the river in 20 minutes. And so the idea was that if you spray this chemical, which we already know is dangerous, onto the soil in the summertime, that has a chance of being broken down, and soil microbes will do their business, and UV light will do its business, and a lot of it will disappear. And so it's a much less hazardous thing. And they actually changed the regulations when they realized that they wanted to use glufosinate-resistant crops. They changed the regulations to allow farmers to spray all year round. And so there are safety issues with the GMO and the idea that you spray a neurotoxin onto a genetically engineered crop right over the top of it, potentially right before you eat it. But secondly, that there are interactions in the regulatory system so that in many cases, and in this one, there are more harms in the environment and more harms to human health because of the fact that this is all being done in conjunction with a genetically engineered crop.
That's right. And let's just spell out this connection here for people who don't know the connection between the GMOs and herbicides. And I'll throw in a link in this interview to a New England Journal of Medicine article that just appeared in August, GMOs, Herbicides, and Public Health, which talks about how two recent developments are dramatically changing the GMO landscape. First, there have been sharp increases in the amounts and numbers of chemical herbicides applied to GM crops, and still further increases, the largest in a generation, are scheduled to occur in the next few years. And second, the International Agency for Research on Cancer has called glyphosate, the herbicide most widely used on GM crops, as a probable human carcinogen, and classified a second herbicide, 2,4-dichlorophenoxacetic acid, 2,4-D, as a possible human carcinogen. So again, there's a lot changing in our understanding of this as it's going on, and that brings to my mind, at any rate, the idea that this is a sort of ongoing open-air public health experiment where the people being experimented on, the general public, generally don't even know this is happening, let alone what the possible risk factors are. Can you speak to that aspect of this, the fact that this is going on without even a lot of public perception of this, and to what extent has the scientific media played into this?
Well, where to start with this issue? I mean, as a scientist, giving people something and they're not collecting any data on their health afterwards, it is not a scientific experiment, right? But at the same time, the companies want to be able to argue that there have been no health effects from the GMOs that they're feeding people. So while I would argue that it's not an experiment, it's just merely uncontrolled contamination of the biosphere and people, there is the industry would like to say that, you know, trillions of meals have been fed without anybody becoming sick. But because they haven't collected any data, and because it's not really a scientific experiment at all, they don't have any basis for saying that. You know, it's perfectly possible, just like with smoking, that millions of people can be harmed by GMOs, but no one notices, right? This kind of, so if you don't collect the data and you don't label the crop that the people are eating and no one knows whether they ate it or not, then there is no basis for calling this an experiment. But also, if they really wanted to call it an experiment, they ought really to obtain people's informed consent, which is a standard practice in experimental methodology. And nobody has ever done that.
Well, that does bring to mind the question of how people like myself, people who are laymen and not specialists in this, can get accurate information about these developments and the research that's ongoing into GMOs, because obviously I think a lot of the mainstream science media does tend to poo-poo these concerns, but there's a lot of alternative news and things out there that are not really grounded in the science either. And it's difficult for the layman to get involved in this. I noticed, for example, in your independentsciencenews.org article that will be linked in the show notes here, there's a lot of references to very scientific types of articles. But how about for Independent Science News? Obviously, independentsciencenews.org is something that should be on my listeners' radar. But are there other sources of information you would recommend?
There are, for example, the Center for Food Safety does a good job with the information that they provide. The Union of Concerned Scientists used to do a good job with the information it provided. They seem to have stopped doing GMO research. And then there are a few websites around the place that there's one called GM Free Cymru, which is spelled C-Y-M-R-U, which is Wales in Welsh. And that does a good job of collecting together all the information. There's a super one called GM Watch, GMWATCH.org. And they do, that's based in Britain. And they do a great job of collecting together. They probably have the most comprehensive list of articles on GMOs. You can follow them on Facebook and social media. They do a really good job of collecting all sorts of stuff, you know, good, bad, and ugly stuff. But they also will provide, you know, they won't share stuff that's really awful, but they will share, will be, people can keep up to date on these issues pretty nicely there. And we publish, you know, our own original content, but they're collecting stuff from around the web and in a really good way.
Excellent. Well, that's good to hear, because I am subscribed to GM Watch's newsletter, so it's good to know that they are spreading good information. I've gotten a lot of good information from them over the years. Well, finally, Dr. Latham, let's wrap up where your article wraps up. You finish by saying, criticism of science and technology remains very difficult. Even though many academics benefit from tenure and a large salary, the skeptical process in much of science is largely lacking. This is why risk assessment of GMOs has been short-circuited and public concerns about them are growing. Until the damaged scientific ethos is rectified, both scientists and the public are correct to doubt that GMOs should ever have been let out of any lab. That's a pretty sweeping statement, one that I think is justified by the concerns that you're raising, but to what extent is this concern of yours shared by your colleagues in the scientific community?
Well, that is a difficult question to answer. I mean, there are people that that I communicate with who work in universities who share those concerns 100%. But these are the kind of people who are happy to put their heads above the parapet. I think there are a lot of scientists who have concerns about the areas in which they work or areas that they know a little bit about that who would really not like to put their heads above the parapet. You know, the university campuses these days are quite a hostile place for people who have opinions that are offensive to multinational corporations. And, you know, universities are so tied into getting money from those multinational corporations that administrators, you know, can cause serious trouble to the careers of people who criticize. And this is true for, you know, for fracking, for nuclear power, for pesticides, for GMOs. There's a whole list of subjects that are basically pretty much taboo at universities to criticize, unless you're prepared to be a pretty darn brave scientist and basically risk having your all your research money taken away and you know, potentially lose your tenure, potentially lose your job, potentially, you know, I know people who've had all of these things happen to them. And, you know, these scientists see what happens to these people, and so they're pretty darn nervous about joining them in that venture of criticizing, you know, the establishment orthodoxy about GMOs and about pesticides and such like. And animal experiments, for example, is another example. And so there is a, you know, you can argue, and I would argue, that academic freedom is close to being extinct in Britain and America. And because of this pressure to commercialize research, universities are so intensely following the bottom line, and they are hiring researchers who don't, you know, who won't criticize people and won't criticize corporations and corporate products. They really would like to steer people away from that. And then the whole funding system, of course, steers people away from that as well. You know, as soon as you start researching the hazards of GMOs, you know, good luck trying to get funding from a national funding agency. And so let me give you an example of this. So pretty much, basically the only research institute in the entire world that is devoted to the risk issues of GMO crops, right? This is a huge experiment in ecological terms and in technological development terms. There's only one institute in the entire world that's devoted to studying these things and from a risk perspective, and that institution is based in Norway. Why is it in Norway? Because Norway has no agribusiness lobby, right? There's pretty much no agriculture and no agribusiness lobby. And so that is the only country which is prepared to invest in that kind of research.
Very interesting. You know, in fact, this topic, this whole idea of the corporate corruption of science is such an important one that it probably deserves a conversation unto itself. But you've certainly provided us with some food for thought for opening that conversation and thinking about the ways that the science that we're that is often reified in a lot of the media as being uncorruptible is in fact quite corrupted by these processes. It's extremely important for all of us, especially on this GMO issue, which, as I say, is really being foisted on a lot of the public without even their knowledge, let alone their consent. So we will continue to stay in touch on this issue. I am glad to be able to recommend independentsciencenews.org to the listeners as one of the outlets by which we can track these issues and other important issues. Dr. Latham, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was fun. Thank you. And I would be very happy to have that conversation at some future date.
Excellent. Well, we will schedule it.
Have a great day.
All right.